she asked, her eyes on General Bortsov. The commanding officer of the Newton moved his head up and down. Nicole activated Rosur. One of the robot surgeon's four hands gunned an anesthetic into the patient, and in 1 minute, Bortsov was unconscious. As Francesca's camera recorded every move of this historic operation, she was whispering occasional comments into her ultra-sensitive microphone. The scalpel hand of Rosur, aided by its twin eyes, made the incisions necessary to isolate the suspect organ. No human surgeon had ever been so swift or deft. Armed with a battery of sensors checking hundreds of parameters every microsecond, Rosur had folded back all the requisite tissue and laid the appendix bare within 2 minutes. Programmed into the automatic sequence was a 30-second inspection time before the robot surgeon would continue with the removal of the organ. Nicole bent over the patient to check the exposed appendix. It was neither swollen nor inflamed.
"Look at this. Quick, Janos," she said,
her eye on the digital clock counting down the inspection period.
"It looks perfectly healthy."
Janos leaned over from the opposite side of the operating table.
"My God," Nicole thought.
"We're going to remove..." The digital clock read 0008.
"Stop it," she shouted. "Stop the operation."
Nicole and Janos both reached for the robot surgeon control box at the same time. At that instant, the entire Newton spacecraft lurched sideways. Nicole was thrown backward against the wall. Janos fell forward, smacking his head against the operating table. His outstretched fingers landed on the control box and then slowly released as he slumped to the floor. General O'Toole and Francesca were both thrown against the far wall. A beep, beep from one of the inserted Hakamatsu probes indicated that someone in the room was in serious trouble physically. Nicole checked briefly to see that O'Toole and Sabatini were all right, and then struggled against the continuing talk to regain her position next to the operating table. With great effort, she pulled herself across the room on the floor, using the anchored legs of the table. When she was beside the table, she steadied herself, still holding onto the legs, and stood up. Blood spattered Nicole as her head crossed the plane of the operating table. She stared with disbelief at Bortsov's body. The entire incision was full of blood, and Rosor's scalpel hand was buried inside, apparently still cutting away. It was Bortsov's probe set that was going beep, beep. Despite the fact that Nicole had inserted, by command, significantly wider emergency values just before the operation. A wave of fear and nausea swept through Nicole as she realized that the robot had not aborted its surgical activities. Holding on tight against the powerful force trying to push her against the wall again, she somehow managed to reach over to the control box and switch off the power. The scalpel withdrew from the pool of blood and restowed itself against a stanchion. Nicole then tried to stop the massive hemorrhaging. 30 seconds later, the unexplained force vanished as suddenly as it had appeared. General O'Toole clambered to his feet and came over beside the now desperate Nicole. The scalpel had done too much damage. The commander was bleeding to death before her eyes.
"Oh no. Oh God," O'Toole said as he surveyed the wreckage of his friend's body.
The insistent beep, beep continued. Now the life system alarms around the table sounded as well. Francesca recovered in time to record the final 10 seconds of Valery Bortsov's life. It was a very long night for the entire Newton crew. In the 2 hours immediately after the operation, Rama went through a sequence of 3 more maneuvers, each, like the first one, lasting 1 or 2 minutes. The Earth eventually confirmed that the combined maneuvers had changed the attitude, spin rate, and orbit of the alien spaceship. Nobody could ascertain the exact purpose of the set of maneuvers. They were just orientation changes, according to the Earth scientists, that had altered the inclination and line of apsides of the Rama orbit. However, the energy of the trajectory had not been changed significantly. Rama was still on a hyperbolic escape path with respect to the sun. Everyone on board the Newton and on Earth was stunned by the sudden death of General Bortsov. He was eulogized by the press of all nations, and his many accomplishments were lauded by his peers and associates. His death was reported as an accident, attributed to the untimely motion of the Rama spacecraft that had taken place during the middle of a routine appendectomy. But within 8 hours after his death, knowledgeable people everywhere were asking tough questions. Why had the Rama spacecraft moved at exactly that time? Why had Rosur's fault protection system failed to stop the operation? Why were the human medical officers presiding over the procedure not able to switch off the power before it was too late? Nicole Desjardins was asking herself the same questions.
She had already completed the documents required when a death occurs in space, and had sealed Bortsov's body in the vacuum coffin at the back of the military ship's huge supply depot. She had quickly prepared and filed her report on the incident. O'Toole, Sabatini, and Tabori had all done the same. There was only one significant omission in the reports. Janos failed to mention that he had reached for the control box during the Raman maneuver. At the time, Nicole did not think his omission was important. The required teleconferences with ISA officials were extremely painful. Nicole was the person who bore the brunt of all the inane and repetitious questioning. She had to reach deep inside herself for extra reserves to keep from losing her temper several times. Nicole had expected that Francesca might hint at incompetence on the part of the Newton medical staff in her teleconference, but the Italian journalist was even-handed and fair in her reportage. After a short interview with Francesca, in which Nicole discussed how horrified she had been at the moment she had first seen Bortsov's incision filled with blood, the life science officer retired to her room, ostensibly to rest and or sleep. But Nicole did not allow herself the luxury of resting. Over and over she reviewed the critical seconds of the operation. Could she have done anything to change the outcome? What could possibly explain Rosso's failure to stop itself automatically? In Nicole's mind, there was little or no probability that Rosso's fault protection algorithms had a design flaw. They wouldn't have passed all the rigorous pre-launch testing if they contained errors. So somewhere, there must have been a human error. Either negligence. Had she and Janos, in their haste, forgotten to initialize some key fault protection parameter? Or an accident during those chaotic seconds following the unexpected talk? Her fruitless searching for an explanation and her almost total fatigue made her extremely depressed when she finally fell asleep. To her, one part of the equation was very clear. A man had died, and she had been responsible. Chapter 18. Postmortem. As expected, the day after General Bortsov's death was full of turmoil. The ISA investigation into the incident expanded, and most of the cosmonauts were subjected to another long cross-examination. Nicole was interrogated about her sobriety at the time of the operation. Some of the questions were ugly, and Nicole, who was trying to husband her energy for her own investigation of the events surrounding the tragedy, lost her patience twice with the interrogators. "Look," she exclaimed at one point, "I have now explained 4 times that I had 2 glasses of wine and 1 glass of vodka 3 hours before the operation. I have admitted that I would not have drunk any alcohol prior to surgery if I had known that I was going to operate. I have even acknowledged, in retrospect, that perhaps one of the 2 life science officers should have remained completely sober. But that's all hindsight. I repeat what I said earlier. Neither my judgment nor my physical abilities was in any way impaired by alcohol at the time of the operation." Back in her room, Nicole focused her attention on the issue of why the robot surgeon proceeded with the operation when its own internal fault protection should have aborted all activities. Based on the user's guide to Rosure, it was evident that at least 2 separate sensor systems should have sent error messages to the central processor in the robot surgeon. The accelerometer package should have informed the processor that the environmental conditions were outside acceptable limits because of the untoward lateral forces. And the stereo cameras should have transmitted a message indicating that the observed images were at variance with the predicted images. But for some reason, neither sensor set was successful in interrupting the ongoing operation. What had happened? It took Nicole almost 5 hours to rule out the possibility of a major error, either software or hardware, in the Rosure system itself. She verified that the loaded software and database had been correct by doing a code comparison with the benchmark standard version of the software tested extensively during pre-launch. She also isolated the stereo imaging and accelerometer telemetry from the few seconds right after the spacecraft lurched. These data were properly transmitted to the central processor and should have resulted in an aborted sequence, but they didn't. Why not? The only possible explanation was that the software had been changed by manual command between the time of loading and the performance of the appendectomy. Nicole was now out of her league. Her software and system engineering knowledge had been stretched to the limit in satisfying herself that there had been no error in the loaded software. To determine whether and when commands might have changed the code or parameters after they were installed in Rosso
required someone who could read machine language and carefully interrogate the billions of bits of data that had been stored during the entire procedure. Nicole's investigation was stalled until she could find someone to help her.
"Maybe I should give this up," a voice inside her said. "How could you?" another voice replied. "Until you know for certain the cause of General Bortsov's death."
At the root of Nicole's desire to know the answer was a desperate yearning to prove for certain that his death had not been her fault. She turned away from her terminal and collapsed on her bed. As she was lying there, she remembered her surprise during the 30-second inspection period when Bortsov's appendix had been in plain view.
"He definitely didn't have appendicitis," she thought.
Without having any particular motive, Nicole returned to her terminal and accessed the second set of data that she had had evaluated by the electronic diagnostician just prior to her decision to operate. She glanced only briefly at the 92% likely appendicitis on the first screen, moving instead to the backup diagnoses. This time, drug reaction was listed as the second most likely cause, with a 4% probability. Nicole now called for the data to be displayed in another way. She asked a statistical routine to compute the likely cause of the symptoms, given the fact that it could not be an appendicitis. The results flashed up on the monitor in seconds. Nicole was astonished. According to the data, if the biometry information input from Bortsov's probe set was analyzed under the assumption that the cause for the abnormalities could not be an appendicitis, then there was a 62% chance that it was due to a drug reaction. Before Nicole was able to complete any more analysis, there was a knock on her door.
"Come in,"
she said, continuing to work at her terminal. Nicole turned and saw Irina Turgenev standing in the doorway. The Soviet pilot said nothing for a moment.
"They asked me to come for you,"
Irina said haltingly. She was very shy around everyone except her countrymen Taburi and Bortsov.
"We're having a meeting of the crew down in the lobby."
Nicole saved her temporary data files and joined Irina in the corridor.
"What sort of meeting is it?" she asked.
"An organizational meeting,"
Irina answered. She said nothing more. There was a heated exchange in process between Reggie Wilson and David Brown when the two women reached the lobby.
"Am I to understand, then," Dr. Brown was saying sarcastically, "that you believe the Rama spacecraft purposefully decided to maneuver at precisely that moment? Would you like to explain to all of us how this asteroid of dumb metal happened to know that General Bortsov was having an appendectomy at that very minute? And while you're at it, will you explain why this supposedly malevolent spaceship has allowed us to attach ourselves and has done nothing to dissuade us from continuing our mission?"
Reggie Wilson glanced around the room for support.
"You're logic chapping again, Brown," he said, his frustration obvious. "What you say always sounds logical on the surface. But I'm not the only member of this crew that found the coincidence unnerving. Look, here's Irina Turgenev. She's the one who suggested the connection to me in the first place."
Dr. Brown acknowledged the arrival of the two women. There was an authority in the way he was asking the questions that suggested he was in control of the gathering.
"Is that right, Irina?" David Brown asked. "Do you feel, like Wilson, that Rama was trying to send us some specific message by performing its maneuver during the General's operation?"
Irina and Hiro Yamanaka were the two cosmonauts who spoke the least during crew meetings. With all eyes turned toward her, Irina mumbled,
"No,"
very meekly.
"But when we were discussing it last night," Wilson insisted to the Soviet pilot.
"That's enough on that subject," David Brown interrupted imperiously. "I think we have a consensus, shared by our mission control officers on Earth, that the Raman maneuver was coincidence and not conspiracy." He looked at the fuming Reggie Wilson. "Now, we have other more important issues to discuss. I would like to ask Admiral Heilmann to tell us what he has learned about the leadership problem." Otto Heilmann stood up on cue and read from his notes. "According to the Newton procedures, in the event of the death or the incapacity of the commanding officer, the crew is expected to complete all sequences then underway in accordance with previous directions. However, once those in-process activities are finished, the cosmonauts are supposed to wait for the Earth to name a new commanding officer." David Brown jumped back into the conversation. "Admiral Heilmann and I started discussing our situation about an hour ago, and we quickly realized that we had valid reasons for being concerned. The ISA is wrapped up in their investigation of General Bortsov's death. They have not even begun to think about his replacement. Once they do start, it may take them weeks to decide.
Remember, this is the same bureaucracy that was never able to select a deputy for Bortsov, so they eventually decided that he didn't need one. He paused several seconds to allow the rest of the crew members to consider what he was saying. Otto suggested that maybe we should not wait for the Earth to decide, Dr. Brown continued. It was his idea that we should develop our own management structure, one that is acceptable to all of us here, and then send it to the ISA as a recommendation. Admiral Heilmann thinks that they will accept it because it will avoid what could be a protracted debate.
Admiral Heilmann and Dr. Brown came to see me with this idea, Janos Taburi now chimed in, and emphasized how important it is for us to get started with our mission inside Rama. They even laid out a strawman organization that made sense to me. Since none of us has the broad experience of General Bortsov, they suggested that maybe we should now have two leaders, possibly Admiral Heilmann and Dr. Brown themselves. Otto would cover the military and spacecraft engineering issues. Dr. Brown would lead the Rama exploration effort.
And what happens when they disagree? Or their areas of responsibility overlap? Asked Richard Wakefield.
In that case, Admiral Heilmann responded, we would submit the item in question to a vote of all the cosmonauts.
Isn't this cute? Said Reggie Wilson. He was still angry. He had been taking notes on his keyboard, but now he stood up to address the rest of the cosmonauts. Brown and Heilmann just happened to be worrying about this critical problem, and they just happened to have developed a new leadership structure in which all the power and responsibility are divided between them. Am I the only one here who smells something fishy?
No, come on, Reggie, Francesca Sabatini said forcefully. She dropped her video camera to her side. There is sound logic in the Strawman proposal. Dr. Brown is our senior scientist. Admiral Heilmann has been a close colleague of Valery Bortsov's for many years. None of us has a solid overall command of all aspects of the mission. To split the duties would be...
It was difficult for Reggie Wilson to argue with Francesca. Nevertheless, he did interrupt her before she was finished. I disagree with this plan, he said in a subdued tone. I think we should have a single leader. And based on what I have observed during my time with this crew, there's only one cosmonaut that we could all easily follow. That's General O'Toole. He waved in the direction of his fellow American. If this is a democracy, I nominate him as our new commanding officer.
There was a general uproar as soon as Reggie sat down. David Brown tried to restore order. Please, please, he shouted. Let's work one issue at a time. Do we want to decide our own leadership and then hand it to the ISA as a fait accompli? Once we handle that question, then we can settle who those leaders should be.
I had not thought about any of this before the meeting, Richard Wakefield said. But I agree with the idea of cutting the Earth out of the loop. They have not lived with us on this mission. More importantly, they are not on board a spaceship affixed to an alien creation somewhere just inside the orbit of Venus. We are the ones who will suffer if a bad decision is made. We should decide our own organization.
It was clear that everyone, with the possible exception of Wilson, preferred the idea of defining the leadership structure and then presenting it to the ISA.
All right, Otto Heilmann said a few minutes later. We must now choose our leaders. One strawman proposal has been advanced, suggesting a leadership split between myself and Dr. Brown. Reggie Wilson has nominated General Michael O'Toole as the new commanding officer. Are there any other suggestions or discussion?
The room was silent for about 10 seconds.
Excuse me, General O'Toole then said. But I would like to make a few observations.
Everyone listened to the American general. Wilson was correct.
Despite O'Toole's known preoccupation with religion, which he didn't force anyone else to share, he had the respect of the entire cosmonaut crew. I think we must be careful at this point not to lose the team spirit that we have worked so hard to develop during the past year. A contested election at this point could be divisive. Besides, it's not all that important, or necessary. Regardless of who becomes our nominal leader, or leaders, each of us is trained to perform a specific set of functions. We will do them under any circumstances. Heads were nodding in agreement around the lobby. For myself, General O'Toole continued, I must admit that I know little or nothing about the inside Rama aspects of this mission. I have never trained to do anything except manage the two Newton spacecraft, assess any potential military threat, and act as a communications nexus on board. I'm not qualified to be the commanding officer. Reggie Wilson started to interrupt, but O'Toole continued without a pause. I'd like to recommend that we adopt the plan offered by Heilmann and Brown and move on with our primary task, namely the exploration of this alien Leviathan that has come to us from the stars.
At the conclusion of the meeting, the two new leaders informed the rest of the cosmonauts that a rough draft of the first sortie scenario would be ready for review the following morning. Nicole headed for her room. On the way, she stopped and knocked on the door of Janos Tavuri. At first, there was no response. When she knocked a second time, she heard Janos yell, "Who is it?"
"It's me, Nicole," she answered.
"Come in," he said. He was lying on his back on the small bed, with an uncharacteristic frown on his face.
"What's the matter?" Nicole asked.
"Oh, nothing," Janos answered.
"I just have a headache."
"Did you take something?" Nicole inquired. "No, it's not that serious." He still didn't smile. "What can I do for you?" he asked, in an almost unfriendly tone. Nicole was puzzled. She approached her subject cautiously.
"Well, I was rereading your report on Valeri's death."
"Why were you doing that?" Janos interrupted brusquely.
"To see if there was anything we might have done differently," Nicole responded.
It was obvious to her that Janos did not want to discuss the subject. After waiting a few seconds, Nicole spoke again.
"I'm sorry, Janos. I'm imposing on you.
I'll come back another time."
"No, no," he said. "Let's get this over with now."
That's a curious way of putting it, Nicole was thinking as she formulated her question.
"Janos," she said, "nowhere in your report did you mention reaching for Rosu's control box right before the maneuver. And I could have sworn I saw your fingers on the keyboard panel as I was being swept over against the wall."
Nicole stopped. There was no expression of any kind on Cosmonaut Tabori's face. It was almost as if he were thinking of something else.
"I don't remember," he said at length, without emotion. "You may be right. Perhaps my hitting my head erased part of my memory."
"Stop now," Nicole said to herself, as she studied her colleague. "There's nothing more you can learn here."
Chapter 19 Rite of Passage. Genevieve suddenly broke into tears.
"Oh, Maman," she said, "I love you so much, and this is absolutely awful."
The teenager hurriedly moved out of the camera frame and was replaced by Nicole's father. Pierre looked off to his right for a few seconds to make certain that his granddaughter was out of earshot, and then turned toward the monitor.
"These last 24 hours have been especially hard on her. You know how she idolizes you. Some of the foreign press have been saying that you bungled the surgery. There was even a suggestion this evening from an American television reporter that you were drunk during the operation."
He paused. The strain was showing on her father's face as well.
"Both Genevieve and I know that neither of these allegations is true. We love you completely and send all our support."
The screen went dark. Nicole had initiated the video phone call and had, at first, been cheered by talking to her family. After her second transmission, however, when her father and daughter had reappeared on the screen 20 minutes later, it had been obvious that the events on board the Newton had unsettled life at Beauvoir as well. Genevieve had been particularly distraught. She had cried intermittently while talking about General Bortsov. She had met him several times, and the avuncular Russian had always been especially nice to her. And had barely managed to compose herself before breaking into tears again, right before the end of the call. "So, I have embarrassed you as well," Nicole thought, as she sat down in her bed. She rubbed her eyes. She was extremely tired. Slowly, without being aware of how depressed she had become, she undressed for bed. Her mind was plagued with pictures of her daughter at school in Luynes. Nicole winced as she imagined one of Genevieve's friends asking her about the operation and Bortsov's death. "My darling daughter," she thought, "you must know how much I love you. If only I could spare you from this pain." Nicole wanted to reach out and comfort Genevieve, to hold her close, to share one of those mother-daughter caresses that chase away the demons. But it could not be. Genevieve was 100 million kilometers away. Nicole lay in bed on her back. She closed her eyes, but did not sleep. She was aware of a deep and profound loneliness, a sense of isolation more acute than any she had felt before in her life. She knew that she was longing for some sympathy, for some human being who would tell her that her feelings of inadequacy were overblown and not consistent with reality. But there was nobody. Her father and daughter were back on Earth. Of the two Newton crew members she knew best, one was dead, and the other was behaving suspiciously. "I have failed," Nicole was thinking, as she was lying on her bed. "On my most important assignment, I have failed." She recalled another feeling of failure when she was only 16. At that time, Nicole had competed for the role of Joan of Arc in a huge national contest associated with the 750th anniversary of the death of the Maid. If she had won, Nicole would have portrayed Joan in a series of pageants over the next 2 years. She had thrown herself totally into the contest, reading every book she could find about Joan and watching scores of video presentations. Nicole had scored at the top in virtually every test category, except suitability. She should have won, but she didn't. Her father had consoled her by telling Nicole that France was not ready for its heroines to have dark skin. But that was not exactly a failure, the Newton Life Science officer told herself. And anyway, I had my father to comfort me. An image of her mother's funeral came to Nicole's mind. She had been 10 years old at the time. Her mother had gone to the Ivory Coast by herself to visit their African relatives. Anawi had been in Ndogu when a virulent epidemic of Hogan fever had swept through the village. Nicole's mother had died quickly. 5 days later, Anawi had been cremated as a Snofo queen. Nicole had wept while Ome chanted her mother's soul through the netherworld and into the land of preparation, where beings rested while waiting to be selected for another life on earth. As the flames had mounted the pyre and her mother's regal dress had begun to burn, Nicole had felt an overpowering sense of loss and loneliness. But that time also, my father was there beside me, she recalled. He held my hand as we watched Mother disappear. Together, it was easier to bear. I was much more lonely during the Poro, and more frightened. She could still remember the mixture of terror and helplessness that had filled her 7-year-old body at the Paris airport on that spring morning. Her father had caressed her very tenderly. "Darling, darling Nicole," he had said, "I will miss you very much. Come back safely to me."
"But why must I go, Papa?" she had replied. "And why are you not coming with us?"
He had bent down beside her.
"You are going to become part of your mother's people. All Senufo children go through the Poro at the age of 7.
Nicole had started crying.
"But, Papa, I don't want to go. I'm French, not African. I don't like all those strange people and the heat and the bugs."
Her father had placed his hands firmly on her cheeks.
"You must go, Nicole. Your mother and I have agreed."
Anawi and Pierre had indeed discussed it many times. Nicole had lived in France all her life. All she knew of her African heritage was what her mother had taught her, and what she had learned from 2 month-long visits to the Ivory Coast with her family. It had not been easy for Pierre to agree to send his beloved daughter off to the Poro. He knew that it was a primitive ceremony. He also knew that it was the cornerstone of the Senufo traditional religion, and that he had promised Oma, at the time of his marriage to Anawi, that all their children would return to Ndugu for at least the first cycle of the Poro. The hardest part for Pierre was staying behind. But Anawi was right. He was an outsider. He would not be able to participate in the Poro. He would not understand it. His presence would distract the little girl. There was an ache in his heart as Pierre kissed his wife and daughter and put them on the plane to Abidjan. Anawi was also apprehensive about the rite of passage ceremony for her only child, a little girl of barely 7 years. She had prepared Nicole as well as she could. The child was a gifted linguist and had picked up the rudiments of the Senufo language very easily. But there was no doubt that she was at a severe disadvantage with respect to the rest of the children. All of the others had lived their whole lives in and around the native villages. They were familiar with the area. To alleviate the orientation problem a little, Anawi and Nicole arrived in Ndugu a week ahead of time. The fundamental idea of the Poro was that life was a succession of phases, or cycles, and that each transition should be carefully marked. Each cycle lasted 7 years. There were 3 Poros in every normal Senufo life. 3 metamorphoses that were necessary before the child could be transformed into an adult in the tribe. Despite the fact that many of the tribal customs faded away with the arrival of modern telecommunications devices in the Ivory Coast villages in the 21st century, the Poro remained an integral part of Senufo society. In the 22nd century, tribal practices enjoyed a renaissance of sorts, especially after the great chaos proved to most of the African leaders that it was dangerous to depend too much on the outside world. Anawi kept a good acting smile upon her face during the afternoon that the tribal priests came to take Nicole away for the Poro.
She didn't want her fear or anxiety to be transferred to her daughter. Nevertheless, Nicole could tell that her mother was troubled.
"Your hands are cold and sweaty, Mama,"
she whispered in French, as she hugged Anawi before departing.
"Don't worry, I'll be all right."
In fact, Nicole, the only brown face among the dozen dark black girls climbing into the carts, seemed almost cheery and expectant, as if she were going to an amusement park or a zoo. There were four carts altogether, two carrying the little girls and two that were covered and unexplained. Nicole's friend from 4 years earlier, Lutua, who was actually one of Nicole's cousins, explained to the rest of the girls that the other wagons contained the priests and the instruments of torture. There was a long silence before one of the little girls had the courage to ask Lutua what she was talking about.
"I dreamt of it all 2 nights ago,"
Lutua said matter-of-factly.
"They are going to burn our nipples and stick sharp objects in all our holes. And, as long as we don't cry, we won't feel any pain."
The other 5 girls in Nicole's cart, including Lutua, hardly said a word for the next hour. By sunset, they had travelled a long way east, past the abandoned microwave station, into the special area known only to the tribal religious leaders. The half-dozen priests threw up temporary shelters and started building a fire. When it was dark, food and drink were served to the initiates, who sat cross-legged in a wide circle around the fire. After dinner, the costumed dancing began. Omer narrated the 4 dances, each of which featured one of the indigenous animals. Music for the dances came from tambourines and crude xylophones, the rhythm being maintained by the monotonic beat of the tom-tom. Occasionally, an especially meaningful point in the story would be punctuated by a blast on the olifant, the ivory hunting horn. Just before bedtime, Omer, still wearing the great mask and headdress identifying him as the chieftain, handed each of the girls a large kit made of antelope hide and told them to study its contents very carefully. There was a flask of water, some dried fruit and nuts, 2 chunks of native bread, a cutting implement, some rope, 2 different kinds of unguents, and a tuber from an unknown plant.
"Tomorrow morning, each child will be removed from this camp," Omer said, "and placed in a specific location, not too far away. The child will have only the gifts in the antelope hide. The child is expected to survive on her own, and return to the same spot by the time the sun is full in the sky on the following day. The hide contains everything that is needed, except for wisdom, courage, and curiosity. The tuber is something very special. Eating the fleshy root will terrify the child, but may also give abnormal powers of strength and vision."
Chapter 20. Blessed Slumber. The little girl had been alone for almost 2 hours before she really understood what was happening to her. Omer and one of the younger priests had placed Nicole right near a small, brackish pond, surrounded on all sides by the high grasses of the savannah. They had reminded her that they would return in the middle of the next day. Then they were gone. At first Nicole had reacted as if the entire experience were a great game. She had taken out her kit made of antelope hide and carefully inventoried the contents. She had mentally divided the food into 3 parts, planning what she would eat for dinner, breakfast, and mid-morning snack. There was not excessive food, but little Nicole judged that it would be enough. On the other hand, when she had visually measured the flask to determine the adequacy of her water supply, she had concluded that it was marginal. It would be good if she could find a spring or some pure running water that could be used in an emergency. Nicole's next activity had been to create a mental map of her location, paying special attention to any landmarks that would help her identify the brackish pond from a distance. She was an extremely organized little girl, and, back at Chiri Mazarin, often played by herself in a wooded, vacant lot very close to her house. In her room at home, Nicole had maps of the wood that she had carefully drawn by hand, her secret hiding places marked with stars and circles. It was when she came upon 4 striped antelope, grazing calmly under the steady afternoon sun, that Nicole first understood how utterly isolated she was. Her first instinct was to look for her mother, to show Anawi the beautiful animals she had found. "But mother is not here," the little girl thought, her eyes scanning the horizon. "I am all alone." The last word echoed through her mind, and she felt an inchoate despair.
She fought against the despair and looked off into the distance to see if she could find any indication of civilization. There were birds all around, and some more grazing animals on the horizon at the limit of her vision, but no sign of any human beings. "I am all alone," Nicole said to herself again, a slight shiver of fear running through her body. She remembered that she wanted to find another source of water, and walked off in the direction of a large grove of trees. The little girl had no idea about distances in the open savanna, although she did carefully stop every 30 minutes or so to ensure that she could still find her way back to the pond. It amazed her that the distant grove did not appear to be coming any closer. She walked on and on. As the afternoon waned, she became tired and thirsty. She stopped to drink some of her water. The tsetse flies surrounded her, buzzing around her face as she tried to drink. Nicole took out the 2 unguents, smelled them both, and applied the worst smelling of the 2 to her face and arms. Her choice was apparently correct. The flies also found the unguent noisome and kept their distance. She reached the trees about an hour before dark. She was delighted to find that she had fortuitously stumbled upon a small oasis in the middle of the great stretch of savannah. There was a strong spring in the grove, where the water rushed out of the ground and formed a circular pool about 10 meters in diameter. The excess water, in turn, trickled out of one edge of the pool and became a creek that ran from the oasis back into the savannah. Nicole was exhausted and sweaty from her long walk. The water in the pool was inviting. Without thinking, she pulled off her clothes, except for her underpants, and jumped in for a swim. The water invigorated and soothed her tired little body. With her head underwater and her eyes closed, she swam and swam, and fantasized that she was in the community pool in her suburb near Paris. In her imagination, she had gone to the piscine, as she generally did once a week, and was playing water sports with her friends. The memory comforted her. After a long time, Nicole rolled over on her back and took a few strokes. She opened her eyes and looked at the trees above her. The rays from the late afternoon sun were making magic as they cut through the branches and the leaves. 7-year-old Nicole stopped swimming and trod water for several seconds, looking around the edge of the pool for her clothes. She didn't see them. Puzzled, she scanned the perimeter of the pool more carefully. Still, she saw nothing. In her mind, she reconstructed all the scenes of her arrival in the grove and conclusively remembered exactly where she had placed both her clothes and a kit made from antelope hide. She climbed out of the water and examined the spot more closely. "This is definitely the place," she thought, "and my clothes and the kit are gone." There was no way to quell the panic. It overpowered her in an instant. Her eyes flooded with tears. A wail broke from her throat. She closed her eyes and wept, hoping that this was all a bad dream and that she would wake up in the next few seconds and see her mother and father. But when she opened her eyes again, the same scene was still there. A half-naked little girl was alone in the wilds of Africa with no food, no water, and no hope of rescue before the middle of the next day. And it was almost dark. With great effort, Nicole managed at last to control both her fright and her tears. She decided to look for her clothes. Where they had been before, she found fresh prints of some kind. Nicole had no way of knowing what kind of animal might have made the tracks, so she assumed that it was one of the gentle antelopes that she had seen that afternoon in the savannah. That would make sense, the little girl thought logically. This is probably the best waterhole in the area. They stopped here and were curious about my things. My splashing must have scared them away. As the light faded, she followed the tracks along a tiny pathway through the trees. After a short trek, she found the antelope hide, or rather, what was left of it, discarded on the side of the path. The kit was torn completely open. All the food was gone. The water flask was mostly drained, and everything else had fallen out, except the unguents and the tuba. Nicole finished the water that was left in the flask and put it with the tuba in her right hand. She discarded the messy unguents. She was about to continue following the path when she heard a sound, halfway between a yelp and a cry. The sound was very close. The path opened into the savannah about 50 meters ahead. Nicole strained her eyes and thought she saw motion, but she couldn't make out anything specific. Then she heard the yelp again, louder this time. She dropped down on her stomach and crawled slowly along the path. There was a small rise 15 meters before the end of the grove. From that vantage point, little Nicole saw the source of the yelp.
two lion cubs were playing with her green dress. Their watchful mother was on the opposite side, staring out into the savannah twilight. Nicole froze in terror as she comprehended that she was not visiting a zoo, that she was out in the wild, and a real African lioness was only 20 meters away. Trembling with fear, she inched back along the path, very slowly, very quietly, lest she call attention to her presence. Back near the pool, she resisted the urge to jump up and run pell-mell into the savannah. "Then the lioness will see me for certain," she thought. "But where to spend the night?" "I'll find a ditch among the trees," she reasoned, "away from the path, and lie still. Then maybe I'll be safe." Still clutching the flask and the tuba, Nicole walked softly over to the spring. She took a drink and filled her flask. Next, she crawled into the grove and found a ditch. Then, convinced that she was as safe as she could possibly be under the circumstances, the exhausted little girl fell asleep. She woke up suddenly with a sensation that bugs were crawling all over her. She reached down and rubbed her bare stomach. It was covered with ants. Nicole screamed, and then she realized what she had done. In a flash, she heard the lioness crashing through the brush, searching for the creature that had made the noise. The little girl shuddered and scraped the ants off with a stick. Then she saw the lioness staring at her, the feral eyes piercing the dark. Nicole was near collapse. In her fright, she somehow remembered what Omer had said about the tuber. She put the dirt-covered root into her mouth and chewed vigorously. It tasted awful. She forced herself to swallow. A moment later, Nicole was rushing through the trees with the lioness chasing her. Branches and leaves cut her face and chest. She slipped once and fell. When she reached the pool, she did not stop. Nicole ran across the water, her feet barely touching the top. She flapped her arms. They had changed to wings. White wings. She was no longer touching the water. She was a great white heron, soaring up, up into the night sky. She turned and looked at the puzzled lioness far below her. Laughing to herself, Nicole intensified her wing motion and rose above all the trees. The great savannah unfolded below her. She could see for over 100 kilometers. She flew across to the brackish pond, turned west, and spotted a campfire. She zoomed towards it, her bird shrieks piercing the calm of the night. Omer awakened with a start, saw the solitary bird spread out against the sky, and made a loud bird cry of his own.
"Renata!"
his voice seemed to ask. But Nicole did not answer. She wanted to fly higher, even above the clouds. On the other side of the clouds, the moon and stars were clear and bright. They beckoned to her. She thought she heard music in the distance, a tinkling like crystal bells, as she soared higher and higher. She tried to flap her wings. They would barely move. They had changed into control surfaces, which now extended to increase the lift in the ultra-thin air. Her aft rockets began to fire. Nicole was now a silver shuttle, thin and sleek, leaving the Earth behind. The music was louder out in orbit. There it was a magnificent symphony, enhancing the beauty of the majestic Earth below her. She heard her name being called. From where? Who could be calling way out here? The sound came from beyond the moon. She changed her heading, pointed toward the void of deep space, and fired her rockets again. She swept past the moon, heading away from the sun. Her speed was still increasing exponentially. Behind her, the sun was growing smaller and smaller. It became a tiny light and then disappeared altogether. There was blackness all around. She held her breath and came to the surface of the water. The lioness was prowling back and forth on the edge of the pool. Nicole could vividly see all the muscles in her powerful shoulders and read the expression on her face. "Please leave me alone," Nicole said. "I won't hurt you or your babies." "I recognize your smell," the lioness answered. "My cubs were playing with that smell." "I too am a cub," Nicole continued, "and I want to return to my mother, but I am afraid." "Come out of the water," the lioness replied. "Let me see you. I do not believe that you are what you say." Summoning all her courage, her eyes riveted on the lioness, the little girl walked slowly out of the water. The lioness didn't move. When the water was only waist deep, Nicole shaped her arms into a cradle and began to sing.
It was a simple, peaceful melody, the one she remembered from the beginning of her life, when her mother or father would kiss her goodnight, put her down in the crib, and then turn out the light. The little animals in the mobile would go round and around, while a woman's soft voice sang the Brahms lullaby. Lay thee down now and rest. May thy slumber be blessed. The lioness rocked back on her haunches and threatened to pounce. The girl, still softly singing, continued walking toward the animal. When Nicole was completely out of the water and only about 5 meters away, the lioness jumped aside and leapt back into the grove. Nicole kept walking, the soothing song giving her both comfort and strength. In a few minutes she was back out at the edge of the savannah. By sunrise she had reached the pond, where she lay down among the grasses and fell fast asleep. Omer and the Sanufo priests found her lying there, half naked and still asleep, when the sun was high in the sky. She could remember it all as if it were yesterday. Almost 30 years ago now, she recalled as she lay still awake in her small bed on the Newton. And the lessons I learned have never stopped being valuable. Nicole thought about the little 7-year-old girl who had been stranded in a completely alien world and had managed to survive. So why am I feeling sorry for myself now? She thought. That was a much tougher situation. Immersing herself in her childhood experience had given her unexpected strength. Nicole was no longer depressed. Her mind was working overtime again, trying to formulate a plan that would give her the crucial answers to what had happened during the operation on Bortsov. She had pushed her loneliness aside. Nicole realized that she would have to stay on board the Newton during the first sortie if she wanted to do a thorough analysis of all aspects of the Bortsov incident. She resolved to bring up the issue with Brown or Heilman in the morning. At length, the exhausted woman fell asleep. As she was drifting into the twilight world that separates waking and sleeping, Nicole was humming a tune to herself. It was the Brahms lullaby. Chapter 21 Pandora's Cube. Nicole could see David Brown sitting behind the desk. Francesca was leaning over him, pointing at something on a large chart that was spread out in front of the two of them. Nicole knocked on the door of the commander's office.
"Hello, Nicole,"
Francesca said as she opened the door.
"What can we do for you?"
"I came to see Dr. Brown," Nicole replied, "about my assignment."
"Come on in,"
Francesca said. Nicole shuffled in slowly and sat in one of the two chairs opposite the desk. Francesca sat in the other. Nicole looked at the walls of the office. They had definitely changed. General Bortsov's photographs of his wife and children, along with his favorite painting, a picture of a solitary bird with outstretched wings soaring above the Neva River in Leningrad, had been replaced by huge sequencing charts. The charts, each one headed by a different name, first sortie, second sortie, etc., covered the side bulletin boards from one end of the wall to the other. General Bortsov's office had been warm and personal. This room was definitely sterile and intimidating. Dr. Brown had hung laminated replicas of two of his most prestigious international scientific awards on the wall behind his desk. He had also raised the height of his chair so that he looked down on anyone else in the room who might be sitting.
"I have come to see you about a personal matter," Nicole said.
She waited several seconds, expecting David Brown to ask Francesca to leave the room. He said nothing. Finally, Nicole glanced in Francesca's direction to make her concern obvious. "She has been helping me with my administrative duties," Dr. Brown explained. "I find that her feminine insight often detects signals that I have missed altogether." Nicole sat silently for another 15 seconds. She had been prepared to talk to David Brown. She had not expected that it would be necessary also for her to explain everything to Francesca. Maybe I should just leave, Nicole thought fleetingly, somewhat surprised to find that she was irritated about Francesca's being there.
"I have read the assignments for the first sortie," Nicole said eventually in a formal tone. "And I would like to make a request. My duties, as outlined in the sequence, are minimal. Irina Tugeniev, it seems to me, is also underworked for the 3-day sortie. I recommend that you give my non-medical tasks to Irina, and I will stay on board the Newton with Admiral Heilman and General O'Toole. I will follow the progress of the mission carefully, and can be available immediately if there is any significant medical problem. Otherwise, Janos can handle the life science responsibilities."
Again, there was silence in the room. Dr. Brown stared at Nicole and then at Francesca.
"Why do you want to stay on board the Newton?"
Francesca responded at length.
"I would have thought that you couldn't wait to see the inside of Rama."
"As I said, it's mostly personal," Nicole answered vaguely. "I'm still extremely tired from the Portsoff ordeal, and I have a lot of paperwork to finish. The first sortie should be straightforward. I would like to be fully rested and prepared for the second."
"That's a highly irregular request," David Brown said. "But under the circumstances, I think we can do it."
He glanced again at Francesca.
"But we'd like to ask a favor of you. If you're not going into Rama, then perhaps you'd be willing to spell O'Toole as communications officer from time to time? Then Admiral Heilman could go inside."
"Certainly,"
Nicole answered before Brown had finished.
"Good. Then I guess we're all agreed. We'll change the manifests for the first sortie. You will remain on board the Newton."
After Dr. Brown was through talking, Nicole still made no move to leave her chair.
"Was there something else?"
he asked impatiently.
"According to our procedures, the life science officer prepares certification memoranda on the cosmonauts prior to each sortie. Should I give a copy to Admiral?"
"Give all those memos to me,"
Dr. Brown interrupted her. "Admiral Heilman is not concerned with personnel matters." The American scientist looked directly at Nicole.
"But you don't need to prepare new reports for the first sortie. I've read all the documents you wrote for General Bortsoff. They are quite adequate."
Nicole did not let herself be cowed by the man's penetrating gaze.
"So you know what I wrote about you and Wilson," she thought. "And you think I should feel guilty, or embarrassed?" "Well, I don't.
My opinions have not changed just because you are now nominally in charge." That night, Nicole continued with her investigation. Her detailed analysis of the biometry data from General Bortsoff showed that he had had extraordinary levels of two strange chemicals in his system just before his death. Nicole could not figure out where they had come from. Had he been taking medication without her knowledge? Could these chemicals, which were known to trigger pain — they were used, according to her medical encyclopedia, to test pain sensitivity in neurologically distressed patients — somehow have been manufactured internally in some kind of allergic reaction? And what about Janos? Why couldn't he remember reaching for the control box? Why had he been reticent and withdrawn since Bortsoff's death? Just after midnight, she stared at the ceiling of her small bedroom. "Today, the crew enters Rama, and I will be here alone. I should wait until then to continue my analysis." But she couldn't wait. She was unable to push aside all the questions that were flooding her mind. Could there be a connection between Janos and the drugs in Bortsoff? Is it possible that his death was not completely accidental? Nicole took her personal briefcase out of the tiny closet. She opened it hastily, and the contents spilled into the air. She grabbed a group of family photographs that were floating above her head. Then she gathered up most of the rest of the items and returned them to her briefcase. Nicole retained in her hand the data cube that King Henry had given her in Davos. She hesitated before inserting the cube. At last, she took a deep breath and placed it into the reader. 18 menu items were immediately displayed on the monitor. She could choose any of the 12 individual dossiers on the cosmonauts, or 6 different compilations of crew statistics. Nicole called for the dossier on Janos Tiburi. There were 3 submenus for his biography: personal data, chronological summary, and psychological assessment. She could tell from the listed file sizes that the chronological summary contained most of the details. Nicole accessed personal data first, to gain familiarity with the format of the dossiers. The brief chart did not tell her much that she didn't already know. Janos was 41 and single. When he was not on duty for the ISA, he lived alone in an apartment in Budapest, only 4 blocks away from where his twice-divorced mother lived by herself. He had received an honors engineering degree from the University of Hungary in 2183. In addition to mundane items like height, weight, and number of siblings, the chart listed 2 other numbers: IE for intelligence evaluation and SC for socialization coefficient. Tiburi's numbers were plus 3.37 for IE and 64 for SC. Nicole returned to the main menu and called up the glossary to refresh her memory about the definitions of IE and SC. The IE numbers supposedly represented a composite measure of overall intelligence, based on a comparison with a similar worldwide student population. All students took a set of standardized tests at specified times between the ages of 12 and 20. The index was actually an exponent in a decimal measuring system. An IE number of 0 was average. An IE index of plus 1 meant the individual was above 90% of the population. Plus 2 was above 99% of the population. Plus 3 above 99.9%, etc. Negative IE indices indicated below average intelligence. Janos's score of plus 3.37 placed him in the middle of the upper 0.1% of the population in intelligence. The SC numbers had a more straightforward explanation. They too were based on a battery of standardized tests administered to all students between the ages of 12 and 20, but the interpretation here was easier to understand. The highest SC score was 100. A person scoring close to 100 was liked and respected by virtually everybody, would fit into most any group, was almost never quarrelsome or moody, and was very dependable. A footnote to the explanation of the SC scores acknowledged that written tests could not accurately measure personality traits in all cases, so the numbers should be used with discretion. Nicole reminded herself to do a comparison sometime of all the cosmonaut IE and SC scores. Then she accessed the chronological summary file for Janos Taburi. The next 60 minutes was an eye-opening experience for Nicole. As the life science officer, she had, of course, studied the official ISA personnel files for the entire crew. But if the information about Janos Taburi on the cube given to her by King Henry was correct, and she had no way of knowing one way or the other, then the ISA files were woefully incomplete. Nicole had known previously that Janos had twice been selected as the outstanding engineering student at the University of Hungary. She had not known that he had been president for 2 years of the Gay Students Association of Budapest. She was aware that he had entered the Space Academy in 2192 and had graduated in only 3 years because of his previous experience with major Soviet engineering projects. She had never been told that he had applied to the Academy twice previously and had been rejected both times. Despite sensational entrance scores, he had twice failed his personal interview. Both times, the interview committee had been headed by General Valery Bortsov. Janos had been active in various gay organizations until 2190. Subsequently, he had resigned from them all and never rejoined or participated in any organized gay activities. None of this information had been in his ISA file. Nicole was stunned by what she had learned. It wasn't that Janos had been, or was, gay that disturbed her. She was free of prejudices where sexual orientation was concerned. What bothered her most was the likelihood that his official file had been deliberately censored to remove all references both to his homosexuality and to his earlier interactions with General Bortsov. The last entries in the Taburi chronological summary were also surprising for Nicole. According to the dossier, Janos had purportedly signed a contract with Schmidt and Hagenest, the German publishing conglomerate, in the last week of December, just before launch. His task was to perform unspecified consulting for a wide variety of post-Newton media endeavors in support of what was referred to as the Brown-Sabatini Project. Cosmonaut Taburi was paid an initial fee of 300,000 marks for signing. 3 days later, his mother, who had been waiting almost a year for one of the new artificial brain implants that reversed the damage from Alzheimer's disease, entered the Bavarian hospital in Munich for neurological surgery. Her eyes weary and burning, Nicole finished reading the extensive dossier on Dr. David Brown. During the hours that she had been studying his chronological summary, she had created a special subfile for herself of those items in the summary that were of particular interest to her. Before trying again to sleep, Nicole scrolled through this special subfile one more time. Summer 2161. Brown, 11. Enrolled in Camp Longhorn by father over strenuous objections of mother. Typical outdoor summer camp in hill country of Texas for upper-class boys, featuring athletics of all kinds, riflery, crafts, and hiking. Boys lived 10 to a barracks. Brown was extremely unpopular immediately. On fifth day, bunkmates seized him coming out of shower and painted his genitals black. Brown refused to move from bed until mother had traveled almost 200 miles to pick him up and take him home. Father apparently ignored son altogether after this incident.
September 2166. After being valedictorian from private high school, Brown enrolled as freshman in physics at Princeton. Remained in New Jersey only 8 weeks. Completed undergraduate work at SMU while living at home. June 2173. Awarded PhD in physics and astronomy by Harvard. Dissertation advisor Wilson Brownell called Brown an ambitious, diligent student. June 2175. Brown completed postdoctorate research on the evolution of stars with Brian Murchison at Cambridge. April 2180. Married Jeanette Hudson of Pasadena, California. Miss Hudson had been graduate student in astronomy at Stanford. Only child, daughter Angela, born in December 2184. November 2181, was refused tenure in astronomy department at Stanford because two members of evaluation committee believed Brown had falsified scientific data in several of his many scholastic publications. Issue was never resolved. January 2184, appointed to first ISA advisory committee, prepared comprehensive plans for series of major new astronomical telescopes on far side of the moon. May 2187, Brown named chairman of Department of Physics and Astronomy at SMU in Dallas, Texas. February 2188, fist fight with Wendell Thomas, Princeton professor, in atrium outside AAAS meeting in Chicago. Thomas insisted that Brown had stolen and published ideas they had discussed together. April 2190, electrified scientific world by not only publishing breakthroughs